commentary I'm using.
Awareness of God and the enemy is virtually the hallmark of every Psalm of David. At this point, if you're thinking to yourself, David may be the guy that complains more about his enemies than anybody I've ever heard. Be reminded of something. This helped me. David's 70 years old when he dies. And I think there are about 70 plus Psalms that he wrote. So it's not like he's sitting around every day writing these or thinking these. There's a moment in his life in which he really genuinely had enemies like Saul and his own son and others that he was asking God to deliver him from his enemies, Philistines, other nations that warred against them. So this is not all of David's life. You wouldn't have gone to see David, and every time he went over to see him, he's complaining about something today. There's plenty of times of praise and thankfulness for what God had done for him. We just sang a couple of songs. I think the last song we sang had some psalm ideas to it. So anyway, that's Jerusalem in the days of David. You probably didn't know that, but I didn't either. What we got going on back here, Brian? It doesn't matter. There we go. All right. We should be aware of God and our enemy. Obviously, we should be very aware of God, mindful of God all the time, and be aware of who our enemy is. And we know who that is, don't we? And we know his tactics. We know how he comes at us. We need not be ignorant of his devices, Paul said. So we're in a battle. Sometimes that battle gets pretty ugly. And so we could cry out these things when we're struggling with temptation. God, help me. You've been my rock. You've been my refuge. You've been my shield. You've helped me before. I really need your help today. So that's the God we serve. He's always there for those who are seeking him and his ways. God will save us. And he will deal bountifully with us. And that comes up several times where David just praises the Lord, how bountifully he had dealt with him, how thankful he was he had saved him. We have a greater salvation and a greater bounty looking forward to in heaven. And that God will truly do for us what he's promised. So that's a background, again, as we think about these, and as I begin to lead us through these psalms, helping us to appreciate some things. And again, if you see something and I don't get to it, I am at a point where I've got to pick it up a little bit, and especially make sure we emphasize any of the psalms that have any reference to Jesus. Okay? Thoughts or comments about anything I've just said, though? All right, we got this fool again saying in his heart, there is no God. So who is this? This is a blatant, militant atheist like Carl Sagan? No, not necessarily. Again, it's somebody who's just hoping God really isn't around. We saw in a previous psalm that he was saying to himself, God doesn't take account of this. And that was because evil men were doing evil things and nothing immediately was happening to them. So maybe God doesn't care. I'm going to live as if he doesn't exist. I remind you that my readings, there are a lot of people who don't want there to be a God for one simple reason. They don't like his rules. And I can narrow that down for you if you'd like in reading some of the things I've read. In fact, Carol Brown, I thought I saw her. But anyway, she recommended a book, The Making of an Atheist. And I can't tell you how many atheists are atheists because they just despise God limiting their sexuality and activity. I don't want a God who says, this is what I got to do with my desires. Blind to the fact that that's the best way to use them. So anyway, That's the kind of person that is driven to be an atheist. So this guy here, you know, the fool says in his heart, they're corrupt, they do abominable deeds, they don't do good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They've all turned aside together. They have become corrupt. There's none who does good, not even one. Now that's about a pessimistic view of the world you possibly could have. Sometimes God speaks in hyperbole and generalities. There were still some, like David, or others who were not like this, but they were still sinners. And of course, when David sinned with Bathsheba, he puts himself right in this category. So, guess what? Verses 1 through 3 are quoted in Romans 3, 10 through 12. In that list where Paul is making the Romans and everybody else aware of the fact that we've all sinned. And that we need this grace that he's about ready to talk about from chapter end of 3 all the way into chapter 11. An amazing grace of God. Psalm 5:9, verse 13 of that text, so we've already seen one of those, again leading us to this thought, the humbling thought, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So Paul takes verses 1 through 3 of Psalm 14 and puts it in that context. Humbling, but needful. Thoughts or comments at least down through verse 3. Yes?
So the wording of the verse, when I guess it is, it's very similar to the wording of the golden calf incident. Get down, they corrupt themselves, they turn aside. Basically, they filthy themselves with the life. And it's the same language. So I believe the fool that says in his heart there is no God is those that knew God and turned aside and no longer acknowledge him as God.
Yeah. Very good. That takes me to Romans 1, to the description of those who do not like to retain God in their knowledge. Very good. Very good. Anybody else? Is anyone seeking after God? Yeah, I think there are. You described nobody looking for him. I think there are people looking for him. And Paul stood at Mars Hill in Athens and a bunch of Greek philosophers, you know, the intellectual elite of the day. He thought they had the answers, or at least was still searching for answers, because they wanted to talk about anything new that come along. And Paul comes along, talks about the resurrection. They haven't heard about that, so let's talk about that. And he talked about it, but he talked about this God who created them. And he said, you know, he's done things that he's done so that people that are kind of groping around in the dark, you know, kind of feel around that maybe they can find him because he's not far from any of us. This one author wrote a book about Jesus called He Came Near. God came near so we can see him, reach out to him, find him. The Lord is looking for those who are looking for him. I heard that, an old preacher say that years ago, and that's we're praying to find those who are looking for him. They have no knowledge. 4 through 5. This is where I've got Romans 1, 20 and 21, 28, describing them very well. They don't want to know. They may be used to know, but they become unthankful in their hearts, and so they've dismissed it. God said of his own people in Hosea, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. Not because they couldn't know, but because they no longer wanted to know. And the sad thing is, it will be a great terror, this text says, when the Lord comes to judge them. They are in great terror, for God is with the generation of the righteous. You would shame the plans of the poor, but the Lord is his refuge. Again, when those in positions of being able to help refuse to help those who need help, God took that into account. Oh, salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. Oh, that salvation would come. That's what he wants. Guess what? It did. It did for us. Jesus came out of Zion, sometime even in a literal sense, crucified near Jerusalem, resurrected, and ascended back to be with the Father. It has come, and we are blessed because of it. that salvation has come through Jesus Christ. Psalm 14. Anybody, please. 15. A psalm of David. O Lord, who will sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue, does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. These are the kind of people who can live with God in his tent. Why would David refer to the house of God at this point as a tent? That's intended to be kind of a simple question. I'm not trying to stump anybody. There's no temple. Temple's built by Solomon. So the ark, you remember, that's when David come to God and said, you know, this ark's over here in his tent. Why don't we build a permanent house for it? And God then replied, said, I've never asked you about that. Never concerned about that, it seems like. But he let him build a house, a permanent place. But David said, if you want to dwell in the house, if you want to be in his family, in his house, David longed to come to the tent, even though he personally couldn't go in there as a priest. He wasn't. But we're the house of God. We're the temple of the Lord today. And so this is the kind of people he wants. Apparently there are some words here, blamelessly and does what's right, speaks truth in his heart, in verse number 2, means the idea of wholeheartedness. Kidner talks about someone who knows what is sure and trustworthy. I would say one who knows who is sure and trustworthy. Any of these things still relevant for us? Your mind go to any New Testament instructions from the apostles? When you read this list, do you read it like, that should be me? Speak truth in his heart. Don't slander. Don't gossip. Don't say things about people that aren't true. And if you say something about somebody and you think it's necessary to tell somebody about something about somebody, especially if it's wrong that they've done, you need to make absolutely certain that it's true, and then you need to ask why you're telling somebody else. But the point of it is, that's what slander is to say something that's just simply not true. Anybody ever had that happen to you? Sometimes it's kind of funny, sometimes it hadn't been. I won't tell you, I'm not filling you with stories, but I won't tell you one of the funniest stories happened to Betsy and I. We were keeping a young couple with us for a few months, they had a little boy, and staying with us, and they were members of the church at Lilburn, and so was her sister. One day, when car was in the shop, and we had one car, Betsy was substitute teaching about a couple miles from our house on a pretty busy road. And so, one day, you know, she went to work, and what I told her was I was going to bring. I dropped her off. I came back, put my bicycle on the back of the car. Dropped the car off so she would get the car and come home, and I got my bicycle and I just rode home on a street you really didn't want to ride a bicycle on. Next thing I know, these two sisters were just mad as me as they could be, hadn't said anything. Said to them, their mom. Said, we can't believe you made Betsy ride her bicycle home from school. I said, time out? Boy, they were mad at me. Her mom was mad at me for 6 months. So I had to clear my name to say, no, I left the car. But, you know, silly things like that, I laugh about it now. It was hurting my influence with her mother, who wasn't a faithful Christian. So I'm going to go to help her, and she looks at me and says, you terrible husband, you made your wife ride her bicycle, you know. Stuff like that ever happened to you? There are times you want to try to clear it up, and then there are other times you just let it roll off your back and forget about it. My point in all of that, and I'm preaching too much about slander, is that it's bad, and we shouldn't be guilty of that. Nobody who does evil to his neighbor. You know, Romans 13, love does no wrong to a neighbor, does no ill to his neighbor, some translations. So again, this is found in the New Testament. It's the fulfillment of the law of God to love your neighbor as yourself. Again, these are things we ought to be concerned about. What about interest? That's interesting. I don't know if you had a chance to a brother borrow money from you. Now, there is another passage that is more specific about the poor among you, Exodus 22:25. If you lend money to any of my people who are poor among you, you shall not be like a money lender to him. You shall not charge him interest. I don't know if there's, you know, what if your brother down here is rich? Again, the question would be, why is he borrowing money if he's rich? But could you charge him interest? Now, you know, that's when you can sit around and debate. But most of us, you know what we do? If we got a brother in need and he needs a loan, we say, here, you know, and then charge him 30% interest. No, we don't. Pay it back when you can. And that's the kind of spirit we ought to have. And God specifically told his people, don't you charge them interest. And guess what? In the days of Nehemiah, they were doing that. And Nehemiah had to reprove his people, days of Ezra and Nehemiah, for doing that. Don't dig up dirt on others. Verse 3, take reproach against his friend. People who honor the kind of people that love the Lord. We honor those who fear the Lord, the kind of people we want to spend time with. Who swears to his own hurt doesn't change. You make a vow and a promise, and even if keeping it is going to cause you difficulty, you keep it. That's the kind of people God wants that are his. Again, the idea of interest. Doesn't take a bribe against the innocent. You know, nobody's going to come to him. And so this innocent person over here, but I'll tell you what, I'll pay you $100,000 if you lie about it, and that'll keep this guy off the hook and he won't have to go to jail. And some innocent person goes. That's awful, terrible. And people do that in the world, but not God's people. He who does these things shall never be moved. And it reminded me of Paul in Corinthians, we are immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. So it's interesting. Psalm 15 kind of pops up here, Psalm of David, where he is praising those, talking about those who walk with the Lord, who can dwell in his tent. Psalm 15. Yes, Rhonda.
Talking about seeking God, he's not far from us. Talking about your wholeheartedly calling the Lord. Well, back in Deuteronomy, he told them, if you will seek me, you will find me. Yeah. So in part of this, you're looking at also one of the lessons for our meeting talked about, don't worry about what all these other people are doing, serve the Lord. So he's going to serve me, don't worry about all this backbiting and your neighbor and whatever's going on. Yeah. Serve the Lord.
Right. Very good.
And about not being moved, I love Psalms 46, the city with the river flowing and it won't be moved.
Very good. Anybody else? 16. We take our refuge in God. That's just repetitive. Paul, David says, I find my refuge in God. I can hide in him. He's my storm shelter. He's my basement. You know, when the news says there's a storm coming across and over there through Brown County and headed our way. And I tell you, this last one that came through, and we were downstairs, and thankfully got a basement and had my computer with me so I could be watching the news. And they show that little hook, you know, that supposedly maybe, you know, a little tornado could come up there. And we're looking at that, and Betsy said, where do we live? And I pointed right in the middle of the hook. But it went north of us, and it didn't spawn a tornado. But anyway, God is that's a picture. Felt safe. And we can feel safe in God. He's forgiven us. He's there, protects us, helps us. God was concerned about his welfare. Interesting verse. Apparently, reading about verses 2 and 3, some challenges in translating some Hebrew texts at times. You are my Lord. I have no good apart from you. The word good apparently could be welfare. And that makes it sense to me, at least, that God says, I'm concerned about your welfare, David. I do care about you. And that's comforting. I have no welfare apart from you. I need the good you, your welfare. You're providing for me, caring for me, taking care of me. Verse 3 seems to be even more difficult for some translations. This is, again, I'm using the ESV for the class. As for the saints in the land, they are excellent ones in whom is all my delight. You get into interesting studies. Saints can be angels, but sometimes it can be in the land, and that seems to be talking about God's people. And that is interesting, by the way, just for what it's worth. Saints is a way God referred to his people in the Old Covenant, not just the New. So, sanctified, set apart people, they're not the ones who run after idols. They delight in the Lord. The Lord delight. The Psalm, David is saying, I delight in these people. He says, the sorrows of those who run after other gods and drink offerings of blood or take their names on my lips, I will not do that. I will not be an idol worshiper. He assures God of that. He's confident that I will not be those things. I'll make this statement about Psalms. Observation. And it's right for us to pray repetitively. Lord, help me. Help me. Help me do this. Help me do this. Help me do this. But I want you to notice sometime there are times the psalmist is definitive. In other words, he said, this is what I'm going to do. Now you tell that to God and see if that doesn't change your heart. That we're always, Lord, I can't do this and you're going to have to help me. Again, we depend on him, but sometime we just need to step up and say to the Lord, as David is saying to him, I delight in the excellent ones. I will not drink the blood of offerings to idols. I will not even take their names on my lips. I will not honor them. Let's be that definitive. There'll be some others we'll see. The Lord is my chosen portion and my lot. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Behold, I have a beautiful inheritance. That's great stuff. Now, the Jews are thinking what? When they hear lot, inheritance, what are they thinking about? Promised land, right? And all the tribes and the lots were given, divided up among the families. So you got to go in there, and you had to pay for it, by the way. God said, this is yours. Vineyards, trees, it was just a blessing. And so they count as a blessing. And it was special. It was important to them. And you know where that goes with us. The Lord holds our lot. He holds it. He holds our place with him. The deed is in heaven. And he holds our place. We're going to look at 18. He brought me out into a broad place. You gave me a wide place for my steps, is the idea. It's a beautiful inheritance, pleasant places. The fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore in this inheritance. How would we apply that to ourselves? I hope that's the way we think about us, our life in Christ, and especially our life, our home with him. We have a hope of heaven, a place reserved for us. It can't be taken away. We have that confidence, and it will be the fullness of joy. There are things in this life make us happy, but that lasts for just a little while. But there are moments of joy that we experience, and those are just taste of heaven. But when we get to heaven, it will be forevermore. What a picture. Let me stop there. I'm down to about verse 11 or so. No, I'm not. Can't be that far. Verse 7, before we look into the last few verses. Oh, and meditating at night on the counsel of the Lord. I find that a blessing, by the way. Sometimes it's... talk about old man stuff, but anyway, you know, if I wake up at 2 or 3 and, you know, need to make a little trip, and I went to bed at 10, and I know the alarm's set for 5:30 and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, that's bad. No, it's good, but it's bad. But my mind just starts racing, you know. Want Bible class and preaching and something else, maybe. But those can be blessings. I've learned to just get up. Now, don't call me at 3 in the morning and see if I'm up, okay? No, that doesn't happen all the time. But I've had some blessings recently. I just got up, I said, and I read my Bible. And just at 3 in the morning, meditating on things that God has said. And David said, I find joy in that. Because he's got those things to think about. Remember how in the first psalm, those that meditate upon the law of the Lord day and night, that man is blessed. It's a blessing to have the Word of God in our hearts and be able to wake up in the middle of the night and thinking about God is there, always talking to us, communicating to us in His Word. Now, 8 and 11. Got to spend some time with this. I have set the Lord always before me because He is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Therefore, my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. The Lord is at my right hand. The picture, He's always there ready to help, within reach, knows what I need. These are things David hoped for, and I believe he hoped for them personally. We know where this is headed. I hope you already know a little bit, because you know where it's headed. These verses are quoted by Peter in the first gospel sermon in Acts chapter 2, in reference to Jesus. But I think this is one of those verses that tells me that the Old Testament faithful recognized there was more than this. And David said, you won't leave my soul in Sheol. That's the grave. The New Testament parallel of Sheol is Hades. You will not leave my soul in Hades. He believed in a resurrection. He believed that death was not the end of his existence. The word corruption, the ESV footnote says, or see the pit. David may not have been thinking specifically about his body, because I guess that his experience, he learned like everybody else, this body returns to the dust of the earth. And he's not thinking about his physical body living on. And maybe pit's a better word. Again, the idea that my soul, the parallelism, remember that? Sometimes God says the same thing twice, a little different way. You will not abandon my soul to Sheol. You will not let your Holy One see the pit, leave him in the pit. You will bring me out. You make known to me the path of life, the path that leads to life in your presence, that he believed someday he would be in the presence of God. There would be fullness of joy and again pleasures forevermore. Fast forward about 1,000 years. Jesus has died for our sins, been raised from the grave, and ascended back to be with his Father, our Father. Day of Pentecost, the apostles are filled with the Spirit, comes upon them, they begin speaking in tongues, the people are amazed. There are people there from all the different nations of Roman Empire, all of a sudden these guys are speaking their language, and they're amazed by that. Some of them even thought silliness, like these guys must be drunk, and Peter dismissed that pretty quickly. He said, it's too early, nobody gets drunk this early in the morning. And then he starts telling about Jesus. He could have answered that other question in more detail, but he said, no, I'm going to get to what I'm here to talk about. I'll talk about Jesus. Quoted Joel and said, these things that you're seeing are what Joel talked about. Men of Israel, hear these words, verse 22, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, some of them were singing his praises on the first day of the week when he came into the city riding the colt of a donkey. Hallelujah, salvation has come. By the end of the week, the Jewish leadership had convinced them he was a farce, and they were crying out, crucify him, crucify him. This Jesus delivered up according to the definitive plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For David says concerning him, I saw the Lord always before me. He is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore, my heart was glad. This is Jesus speaking. Imagine Jesus saying this. The Lord is at my right hand. He knew his Father was there to help. His heart was glad. His tongue rejoiced. He knew his flesh would dwell in hope. He would not be abandoned, his soul in Hades, or let your Holy One see corruption. Now that literally happened to the body of Jesus. You've made known to me the paths of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence. Peter said, brothers, I say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he is both dead and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. I mean, they could have gone over and rolled over the stone and went in there and probably saw nothing but bones. David's bones in the tomb that he was buried in 1,000 years before. Being therefore a prophet, knowing that God has sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. Did David know all of that when he said all of this? Maybe not. But what a foreshadowing of the blessings we have in Jesus because of what he's done for us. Jesus in the Old Testament in the New Testament. Thoughts or comments, Psalm 16. Isn't that great? That's just great stuff. Encouraging. Psalm 17. Oh, here we go. David's complaining again. You know, well, again, he had days. And he cries out to God in this case, hear a just cause, O Lord, attend to my cry, give ear to my prayer from the lips free of deceit. From your presence let my vindication come, let your eyes behold the right. So David here declares his faithfulness. This may have been before Bathsheba and Uriah. None of these statements is David saying, I've never sinned, but you know, just look at his life. He said, I'm striving to live a faithful life in the presence of you, and now I'm being slandered, I'm being ridiculed, I'm being run out of the capital. If this is still talking about things like Absalom, I've got the madman Saul trying to kill me. Whatever it was going on in his life, they're lying about him, and he says, I want you to vindicate me, please. Compare that with Job's plea to the Lord. Job wanted the Lord to vindicate him. And more and more my understanding of Job is he wanted God to vindicate him in the presence of his friends who are battering him daily. You are awful, ungodly sinner. That can be the only reason why this has happened to you. I think for Job, he's trying to shut up his friends because they had become miserable comforters. So, again, kind of back to that, there may be times in our life we want the Lord to vindicate us. And he might, if it's necessary. He pleads that he's been faithful to the Lord, verses 3 through 5. I've been faithful to you. And then he calls for the Lord, is again showing mercy. Protect me, keep me as the apple of your eye. Isn't that a great phrase? You wonder where some of these phrases we get. It's literally the pupil, what it means. I don't know about you, but pupil's pretty sensitive. That's why God's given us this and this and eyelids. I mean, he's provided protection. Protect me. That's what he's calling for. Protect me. Hide me in the shadow of your wings. You hear Jesus, Matthew 23, what do you want to do with the Jews? Gather them under his wings like a hen. Protect them from the storm. So you hear these phrases. From the wicked who do me violence, my deadly enemies who surround me, verse number 9. They close their heart. They have no pity on him. Their mouths, they speak arrogantly. They have surrounded our steps. They set their eyes to cast us to the ground. This may be more than just David. It may be a nation that's rose up against Israel. He's like a lion eager to tear, as a young lion lurking in ambush. Apply that to the devil if you want, because that's exactly what he's trying to do to us. Arise, O Lord, confront him, subdue him. Deliver my soul from the wicked by your sword. Again, come to my aid. Come and help me. Deliver me from men by your hand, O Lord, from men of the world whose portion is in this life. They fill their womb with treasure. They are satisfied with children, and they leave their abundance to their infants. Man, there's something to be learned from that passage. The men of the world whose portion is in this life alone. There are people, as you know, this is all they live for, this life. Accumulating, richer. Children are healthy, grandchildren, they're living in big, great, nice mansions like their parents, and just rich and just got money, and they can do whatever they want. You know, they're got their own private jets, and, you know, there's people like that. And they live life, and they're healthy, and they die when they're 90 years old. And they pass all that on to their kids. I hope none of us are looking at that as a goal of life, because that's all it is, a portion of this life. We know the greatest legacy we can leave our kids and our grandkids, and that's our faithfulness to God. If you don't leave them a dime, make sure we leave them that. So the worldly people here, that's what they're concerned about, not the things of God. And then he closes. Listen to this. As for me, I shall behold your face in righteousness. When I awake, I shall be satisfied with your likeness. Why I haven't used that in a couple of sermons, I don't know. Wow. David said, that's what I want. I just want to see your face and want to be like you. That sound like a good goal for Christians? It does. But we all, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed. We're being changed right now into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord. God has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians 4:6. Revelation 22:4, they shall see his face. I have any idea what this is going to be like. I don't know what God looks like. All these pictures of his face being towards us, looking upon us favorably, versus when he turns his back and he's angry with us. This is a grand picture. He's going to look at me like a grandfather, and all of you guys, grandfathers or parents, or, you know, be gone a week or so and come home and the kids run out, you know. I know, not when they're 16 and 17. They don't do that anymore. But anyway, still love you. Have grown to love you in later years. My point is, it's just a beautiful picture that I'm going to look upon the face of God as you're going to look upon me. He saved me, brought me home, transformed. I will be in his likeness once and for all. And that's our hope. Thoughts or comments through Psalm 17, please. So what we're getting out of these, maybe just highlight some things. I would highlight that. I would highlight that as our goal. I would highlight 16 as remembering that this is our hope, that God is going to deliver us from the grave, and He has done that. We have victory in Jesus, 1 Corinthians 15. I would characterize 15 again as a picture of the kind of people God can live with God. So remember some of those along the way. All right, y'all doing great. What I mean by that, you are listening. I'm not talking about you're not saying anything, but it's helping. But anyway, I want you to say something, okay? I want you to do that. All right. Song number, what is it? And John's agreed to do this, and I appreciate him doing that. We're going to sing, "I Will Call Upon the Lord." All right, guys, we have to start this off, don't we? Start it off. And blessed be my rock, exalted be the God of my salvation. Thank you, John. Is there any question about this psalm, about what it's about? David wrote this after he'd been delivered from his enemies. You can kind of imagine he's just sitting at home, and the story of Saul is past, and the story of Absalom, in fact, it mentions him, it mentions his enemy, not Absalom, but it's the hand of Saul. And he realized he'd been delivered as he prayed. And he begins to write this song, and these are the words that he wrote, which, by the way, are found in 2 Samuel 22, basically word for word. So this psalm, we find it actually when he wrote it in 2 Samuel 22. This is the psalm you sing after you've gone through some really hard things, and you stop and think, God has seen me through. God has brought me through. There are things for us to remember in this text, and this is a 50-verse psalm, so I'm going to go through a little quicker. How much time do I have, Brian? Does it say there? 3 minutes? Perfect. I can do 50 verses in 3 minutes. No. These are my highlights. We have been and will be saved from the cords of Sheol and the snares of death, verse 5, or previous. Nature, verses 7 through 15, can be a model of God's judgment. And you see on the news when we're living in a place where there are tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes, those are pictures that God has judged His people using those things, obviously, the flood. verses 20 through 30, the Lord rewards the righteous. The humble submit to him in obedience. This word proves to be true. Those are highlights, 27 and 30. 31 through 42, the Lord gives the strength and training. Let me catch up here a little bit, maybe to help, maybe a little bit. He gives the strength and training and support from God in battle. God's got our back. Anybody that's been involved in the military and at war know that they've got your back. They've trained you. They've given you the strength to prepare and be ready to defeat the enemy. That's verses 31 through 42. Now, 43 through 40, 50. You deliver me from strife with the people. You made me the head of the nations. People whom I have not known served me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortresses. The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of my salvation, the God who gave me vengeance and subdued peoples under me, who delivered me from my enemies. Yes, you exalted me above those who rose against me. You rescued me from the man of violence. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. Sing to your name, great salvation he brings to his king, and so steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. Were those things true of David? Yes. But Paul said in Romans 15, for this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations, and sing to your name, verse 49. Paul quotes it in Romans 15, and guess who he's talking about? Jesus. 43 through 50. Is talking about your Lord and mine. Thank you. I'm still about 8 songs behind, but anyway, we'll pick it up. Thank you. Appreciate it. 19.